Hi, and welcome to the Carlat Psychiatry Report in audio format. My name is Dr. Greg Malzberg. I'm the Multimedia Editor-in-Chief at Carlat, and I'll be your narrator through this month of the Carlat Psychiatry Report for August 2024. Our focus article this month is on novel treatment options for OCD. We have our expert Q&A with Dr. David Jobes, who shows us how to empower patients while collaboratively assessing suicidality. And our second article will be on transcranial direct current stimulation. Let's jump right in. Our feature article this month is Novel Treatment Options for OCD, written by Edmund S. Higgins, MD, who's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the Medical University of South Carolina. Dr. Higgins reports stock ownership in Bristol-Myers Squibb and Johnson & Johnson. Dr. Aiken, our editor-in-chief, has reviewed this educational activity and determined that there is no commercial bias as a result of this financial relationship. Let's get to the article. Novel treatment options for OCD. Ever since the approval of clomipramine in 1989, pharmacotherapy for OCD has revolved around SSRIs. Their benefits, however, are not as impressive as we'd like. Recently, treatments with novel mechanisms have found success in clinical trials, including ondansetron and deep transcranial magnetic stimulation, DTMS, and aripiprazole. In this article, I'll look at where these off-label treatments fit in practice. Start with serotonergic medications. SSRIs are first-line medications for OCD, but they require higher doses and longer durations than they do for depression. Titrate to the target dose in the table. The table is serotonergic medications for OCD and lists the optimum dose and maximum dose. So for example, the optimum dose for citalopram is 60 and the maximum is 80 to 120. So titrate to the target dose in the table and then allow 4 to 6 weeks for a response. If there is no response, raise to the maximum dose for another 2 to 4 weeks. If the patient has not reached a meaningful level of recovery after 8 to 12 weeks at the maximum dose of an SSRI, you can consider clomipramine. This highly serotonergic tricyclic has a slightly higher effect size in OCD than the SSRIs. Obsessions may persist during recovery, but they recede to the back of the mind, and the patient is typically able to move past them. Clomipramine is fairly well tolerated, but it brings new risks, such as seizures and delays in cardiac induction, especially when taken in high doses. Most SSRIs raise clomipramine levels, so taper off the SSRI first, or titrate clomipramine slowly if you choose to cross-taper the drugs. Citalopram and escitalopram are the exceptions. When serotonergics fail, several augmentation options are available for patients who don't respond to a full trial of an SSRI and clomipramine. A recent analysis identified 19 treatments with at least 2 placebo-controlled trials in SSRI-resistant OCD, concluding that ondansetron, aripiprazole, DTMS, and CBT were the most effective. I'll walk through those and other options, starting with the best tolerated of the bunch, ondansetron. Ondansetron. This repurposed nausea medication is possibly the most effective add-on for OCD. It modulates 2 neurotransmitter systems involved in OCD, serotonin and dopamine. Furthermore, it's well tolerated, an important feature in this disorder where obsessional thinking often magnifies adverse effects. Ondansetron's main side effect is constipation, although QT prolongation is also a risk. Although we're discussing augmentation in this review, there are reports of monotherapy with ondansetron for OCD, which could make it a better option for patients with bipolar disorder and OCD. Antipsychotics. Antipsychotic augmentation is a popular strategy in many disorders, but it is not as effective in OCD as often imagined. The effect size are on the small side, and in the rare cases, antipsychotics can exacerbate OCD, particularly olanzapine and clozapine. Among the options, aripiprazole is a good place to start. It is on the more favorable side for tolerability and was superior to quetiapine in a head-to-head comparison. In most studies, the antipsychotic was added to an SSRI, but in a few trials, it was used as monotherapy, particularly in bipolar disorder. Anticonvulsants. Topiramate and lamotrigine offer an alternative mechanism of action through their glutaminergic effects. The research here is limited, with two small controlled trials supporting topiramate and one supporting lamotrigine, both as augmentation in treatment-resistant cases. Adamantanes. Memantine and amantadine are classified as adamantanes, based on their shared chemical structure. They modulate two neurotransmitter systems that are implicated in OCD, glutamate and dopamine. Memantine improved OCD in 5 out of 6 small randomized controlled trials, where it worked within 8 weeks. Amantadine augmentation has only one small randomized trial supporting its efficacy in OCD. Those psychotic symptoms are a risk with amantadine. DTMS. Brain stimulation devices, like any medical device, are cleared by the FDA for the specific device, not the general concept. So most TMS devices are not cleared for OCD. Only the BrainWay H7 coil has the green light from the FDA. The H7 coil is an unusual-looking device that sits on the patient's head, much like the hairdryer that sat on my mother's head at the beauty salon. As an option for OCD, DTMS is superior to regular TMS. The BrainWay H7 coil can generate a signal that reaches deeper into the brain than regular TMS, aiming for the cingulate cortex, which likely explains its superior outcomes. In general, most patients require 30 daily sessions to achieve a response, but 10 to 15 additional sessions to reach remission, depending on the baseline severity. The benefits typically last at least 1 year. The major problem with DTMS is the limited number of devices available. The company estimates there are about 400 units in the US, most of which are clustered around big cities or academic centers. Studies find that inducing obsessive thoughts just before stimulation enhances outcomes. Patients meet with a therapist to devise an exposure scenario to use during treatment. For example, someone with a germ phobia might agree to place a dirty rag on their hands while they receive DTMS, pairing the symptom with the brain stimulation. CBT. The type of CBT that treats OCD is intensive, involving regular exposure exercises where the patient engages with obsessional triggers, for example, a dirty tissue, and resists compulsions, hand washing, until their anxiety recedes on its own, which is a slow process that can take up to 90 minutes. When this exposure response prevention, CBT, is available and the patient is willing, therapy can bring impressive results and have more lasting effects than medications. Carlett verdict. DTMS and CBT have the best evidence in treatment-resistant OCD, but these therapies are not available in all communities. Among the augmentation strategies, ondansetron is a good place to start. There's a side box in this article about OCD and bipolar disorder. About 1 in 5 people with bipolar disorder have symptoms of OCD, much more than expected by chance. This comorbidity presents a challenge because antidepressants can worsen the course of illness, triggering mania, mixed states, or rapid cycling. In this issue, we cover several augmentation options for OCD that are not antidepressants. Several of these were tested without SSRIs in patients with bipolar disorder and comorbid OCD. These medications are aripiprazole, memantine, quetiapine, and topiramate. The others are either FDA-approved in bipolar disorder, lamotrigine, or have no known potential to worsen the illness, amantadine and ondansetron. Ondansetron, which also improves binge drinking, did not cause mania when tested in a controlled trial of 70 patients with comorbid bipolar and alcohol use disorders. Anecdotally, I've used ondansetron in over 100 patients with bipolar disorder and OCD and have not seen worsening mood. The first step is to treat the mood disorder. OCD symptoms are more common during depression than mania and often go away as the mood episode resolves. If OCD symptoms persist, CBT, DTMS, and any of the augmentation options in the augmentation and OCD table would be appropriate, starting with the best tolerated. We know a lot about the side effects of these meds, but do not have enough efficacy data to make them rise to the top. There's also a helpful table titled Augmentation and OCD that lists the different medications, their target doses, and some helpful notes. Time to move on to our Q&A with the expert. This month's Q&A is titled Suicide Assessment and Treatment and is with Dr. David A. Jobes, PhD, ABPP, who's a professor of psychology and associate director of clinical training at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and is author of Managing Suicidal Risk, A Collaborative Approach. Dr. Jobes is the founder and co-owner of CAMS Care LLC, which offers training in collaborative assessment and management of suicidality. He receives royalty from Guilford Press. Dr. Aiken, our editor-in-chief, has reviewed this educational activity and has determined that there is no commercial bias as a result of this financial relationship. So let's get to the interview. Tell us about your approach to suicidality. It's the Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicidality, CAMS for short. We start by asking to take a seat next to the patient, both figuratively and literally. People who are suicidal may feel vulnerable and powerless with a mental health professional, and we want them to regain a sense of control in the therapeutic relationship. We share a clinical tool called the Suicide Status Form, where in the first session, the patient writes out their responses to different quantitative and qualitative prompts. Together, we learn about the internal struggle that they're having with suicide and why they think suicide might be a solution to some of their problems. We also collect information about their history, their thoughts of suicide, whether they have any access to lethal means, things like that. What do you do with the information? First, we develop a stabilization plan. That's not novel, but what is novel is that we ask the patient what makes them want to kill themselves. We ask, what do you need to treat to save your life? Their answers are often about relationships and job struggles, their despair. We have college students saying the earth is dying, or talking about racial and gender oppression. The patient is the expert of their experience, and the CAMS clinician rallies around that perspective. Do you ask the patient to estimate their own suicidal risk? Absolutely. We ask them to rate their psychological pain, their hopelessness, and their overall risk. Another novel part about the assessment is the patient writes out reasons for living and reasons for dying. They write out what they're hopeless about. Patients really like that part. It conveys that they know best about their own struggle and puts their experience at the center of the assessment and treatment. Do you then look for ways to reduce their suicidal risk? Not exactly. Our focus is on reducing their suffering. We start by identifying why they want to take this drastic step. We're taught that suicide is an irrational act, but in this therapy, there's a lot of validation. How do you walk that line? I don't think suicide is necessarily a rational act, but it is an understandable act. I've never interviewed a patient who didn't have legitimate needs and causes behind their suicidality. In CAMS, we ask them to hit the pause button, as in, do you have to end your life to get your needs met? We start with helping them build skills to survive the challenges they are facing. But over the 6 to 10 sessions of therapy, we shift our focus to reasons for living. We look for what would give them purpose and meaning. A useful question I've taken from your book is, what is one thing in your life that, if it changed, would make you not want to kill yourself? Yes, that comes from Sean Shea, who calls it the miracle question. People will say, if I could just get my meds right, I'd be fine. Others want to win the lottery. Part of the therapeutic work is turning those ideas into realistic, concrete, achievable goals. Writing the answer down helps. It allows the patient to see their perspective from the outside. What do the outcomes for CAM show? The biggest effect is increasing hope and decreasing hopelessness. CAMS also reliably reduces suicidal ideation and overall suffering. That comes from a meta-analysis where it was compared to other treatments for suicidality. It's less clear whether CAMS reliably reduces suicide attempts, as there have been some mixed findings. There was a German inpatient randomized control trial that showed a significant reduction in attempt behaviors at 1 month post-discharge, but this finding needs replication. how do you manage the power dynamics around involuntary commitment? That dynamic begins to change when we say, of course you can kill yourself. The issue is that as a licensed professional, I have to take steps to protect you if you're in imminent danger. That sounds provocative, and it has to be said in the right context to convey honesty and transparency. Similarly, we can say, about 130 Americans will have taken their lives by midnight tonight. Do you have to be one of them? Or is there merit in seeing if we can treat what makes you suicidal so you don't have to kill yourself? We all get to be dead forever, so what's your hurry? Instead of wagging my finger and saying, you can't kill yourself, I say, you can, but I can't let you according to law. Can we find a way to not fight about that? Are you also transparent about the fact that ultimately, even hospitalization won't entirely prevent suicide? Absolutely. We put all our cards on the table face up and hand the patient the clinician's playbook. We don't do the patient any favors by holding back the rules that our civil society has created to protect people from themselves. Laying it out like this gets us on the same team, working for common goals. How do you approach suicidal thoughts? In our early clinical trials, the goal was for the patient to have no suicidal thoughts for at least 3 sessions. But in studying people who are living well after a suicide attempt, we often hear them say, suicide is with me even though I'm doing well. I don't see myself killing myself anytime in the near future, but I don't necessarily want to get rid of these thoughts. So my view on all this is evolving. I think that as long as patients are behaviorally stable and managing their thoughts and feelings, that is a successful outcome. But ultimately, our goal is for them to pursue a life that's worth living. Is suicide a comforting idea to some patients, as in, I always have an out? Absolutely. For some people, it's like a warm blanket. But for others, it's like a hot potato they want to get rid of and they don't know where to toss it. Do patients ever push back against the concept of hope? Like it's unrealistic Pollyanna talk? Yes. One way we learned this was from a Swiss study where we asked about reasons for living and reasons for dying. Clinicians were very excited about reasons for living, but in the 2-year follow-up, we found the reasons for living didn't predict any of the outcome variants. After a suicide attempt, most patients are focused on reasons for dying. So if I'm their clinician, it can be invalidating and even shaming for me to say, well, what about your kids? What about your work? What about all the people who rely on you? We now ask about reasons for living later, when the therapeutic alliance is in place and some traction in treatment has been realized. Sometimes when I get asked about reasons to live, the answer sounds like an afterthought, like, maybe my dog? Yes. That can be an empathic failure. What they're hearing is, you want me to have these reasons, but nothing's coming up, so they are for you, not for me. That can change after a few sessions, though. We see hope come into the picture and lean into it. What would give you purpose and meaning? What would make your life worth living? How do you get people to put the suicidality on hold and join with you to head in a positive direction? People with suicidal thoughts are ambivalent. I just point out the obvious, which is people die by suicide. You can do that. So what's the urgency? Why wouldn't you do this treatment with me that's helped so many people around the world with everything to gain and nothing to lose? You can always kill yourself later, but if you're going to be in treatment with me, you're going to need to be all in. It does not work if you only have one toe in the water of treatment and the rest of you is attached to suicide. So while you don't have to do this treatment, if you decide to do it, you have to be all in to save your life. How long does it take to get patients all in? I'll say, let's give it 6 or 10 sessions and make an earnest attempt. You are probably here with me because you're ambivalent. So maybe we should honor that ambivalence and understand that part of you that hasn't already ended your life. Are you comfortable treating a suicidal patient exclusively through telehealth? Absolutely. Expanding access to suicide-focused care has the power to lower the suicide rate. You'll want to have thorough and thoughtful informed consent. Ideally, you'll also have a third party, like a spouse, friend, or parent, involved in case you need to contact them. A meta-analysis found that telehealth psychotherapy was as effective as face-to-face therapy for a variety of psychiatric conditions, and it was actually more effective regarding cognitive behavioral treatments for depression. Recently, one of our clinicians was able to watch a patient get rid of their medication stash through a video session on the patient's laptop. Tell us more about safety planning in CAMHS. During interviews, people with lived experience of being suicidal have told us safety planning feels controlling and paternalistic. In CAMHS, we use a stabilization plan that is embedded within our suicide-focused treatment. We'll talk about what the stabilization plan can mean for them and how the brain changes during a suicidal crisis, where the limbic system is highly activated and the prefrontal cortex that controls behavior goes quiet. Using one's stabilization plan can help downregulate the limbic system and bring back judgment and behavioral control. How long does a suicidal crisis last? Some people ideate most of the day. Others have a low level of ideation that spikes when bad things happen. The spikes may be brief, like 60 to 90 minutes, but that amount of time can feel like an eternity. The CAMHS stabilization plan can help patients weather that crisis without any devastating action. The CSP should be written down, often on their phone, as they are not likely to remember it in that state of mind. In the plan, we also talk directly about limiting access to lethal means and about people whom the patient can reach out to for help. We also use a tool called the Stabilization Support Plan for parents, spouses, significant others, or good friends to help support their loved one within a suicidal crisis. If a patient dies by suicide during treatment, do you meet with the family? A lot of attorneys will say, don't talk to the family. But when you talk with the family, instead of defensively circling the wagons with attorneys, it actually helps reduce malpractice suits. Marsha Linehan, who developed dialectical behavioral therapy, had a whole protocol when she lost patients. She would bring the family in and talk about their grief. She would go to the funeral. In the CAMHS framework, we often bring the family into the early sessions. We've usually had a discussion with family about the hopes and limitations of suicide-focused clinical work, so they are not totally shocked by a tragic outcome, but it is always heartbreaking for all involved. Thank you for your time, Dr. Jobes. Our next article is Transcranial Direct Current Stimulation by Kelvin Quinones Larquente, MD, PhD, psychiatry resident at NYU. Transcranial Direct Current Stimulation, which I'll refer to as TDCS from now on, is a non-invasive brain stimulation device that uses a low-intensity current to stimulate specific areas of the brain. Although popular for depression and other conditions, it is not cleared by the FDA. A growing community of students, professionals, and hobbyists, as well as people with mental health conditions, are using TDCS devices at home. They may be using TDCS to enhance their cognitive abilities or to alleviate certain physical or mental health conditions. Many purchased commercially available TDCS devices online. They're about $100 to $500. Or they build their own using kits, which can be $20 to $150. Is TDCS effective? While TDCS for depression treatment is backed by controlled trials, its evidence base isn't as solid as that of established therapies, and its effect size is fairly small, about 0.3. This effect size was determined from a meta-analysis of 11 TDCS studies focused on depression that used sham devices as controls. Nearly all the studies reviewed suffered from small sample sizes, less than 100 participants, and showed mixed results. One of the larger, more statistically robust studies divided 120 participants with major depressive disorder into four groups: TDCS with placebo, TDCS with sertraline, and their respective sham counterparts. Notably, 20% of the participants had treatment-resistant depression. The results showed that combining sertraline with TDCS led to a 12-point reduction in the Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale compared to placebo, while TDCS alone increased the MADRS score by 6 points. This highlights the enhanced effectiveness of combination therapy as reported in the April 2013 CARLAT report. TDCS also holds promise for treating other conditions, such as generalized anxiety disorder and ADHD, but the data supporting these uses are limited and based on smaller trials. Is TDCS safe? The FDA has not cleared TDCS for any indication, so it is always prescribed off-label. It is not without risk. Patients may lack the knowledge or training necessary to use the devices safely and effectively, and there is a risk that the user will push the voltage beyond the study range. This can cause skin irritation on the stimulation areas, neck pains, headaches, and tingling sensations. Additionally, any unmonitored psychiatric treatment carries safety concerns. Depression affects judgment in ways that interfere with insight and treatment planning, leading to delays in recovery or, in the worst case, suicide. Mechanism of action. Like TMS, TDCS operates via electromagnetic fields to evoke neural activity. However, the two methods differ in their intensity and the nature of their stimulation. TMS applies robust magnetic pulses that are capable of inducing action potentials, the swift alterations in transmembrane neuronal voltage that transmit information. On the other hand, TDCS uses a substantially weaker current, between 0.5 and 2 milliamperes, that doesn't prompt action potentials. Rather, it can subtly modify the voltage within neurons. For a point of reference, ECT administers approximately 800 milliamperes per impulse, a significantly higher amount. Researchers still don't fully understand the underlying mechanisms of TDCS, but the technique may influence the activity of neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine. Enhanced neuronal signaling has been noted when TDCS is combined with substances like citalopram or levodopa. Additionally, evidence from animal models suggests that TDCS might boost neuroplasticity, a vital process for learning and memory. This observation was derived from experiments where TDCS was paired with thalamic stimulation. Clinical practice insights. Can TDCS predict TMS response? We have no head-to-head studies of the two methods, but we know that their mechanisms differ as described earlier. We also know that other forms of electromagnetic stimulation therapy, like ECT, are effective as adjunctive treatments for depression. Serotonergic and dopaminergic medications also appear to synergize with TDCS, which makes it favorable when supplementing ongoing pharmacotherapy. If your patient decides to pursue TDCS, have them track their symptoms with a rating scale like the PHQ-9 before and after TDCS. Dosing depends on three parameters: current, duration, and location. The current is between 1 and 2 milliamperes. The duration is 20 minutes daily for 5 to 15 days. Most studies place the anode patch over the left dorsolateral and ventromedial cortex, known as F3 in EEG placement, and the cathode patch over the right supraorbital area of the forehead, F4 in EEG placement. These locations can be identified with three head measurements: head circumference, the distance from the nose to the back of the head, and the distance from ear to ear. You can find software that helps pinpoint this area at www.clinicalresearcher.org/software.htm. Finally, for a primer on how to implement TDCS, see www.tinyurl.com/4ZCEU4KZ. CARLAT verdict. TDCS involves passing direct current across the brain. It is weaker than TMS, but it has some benefits for depression. It is not recommended for treatment-resistant depression. Our last article is our research update in psychiatry, titled "Antipsychotic Dosing: Differences Between Bipolar Mania and Schizophrenia," written by Kate Travis, MD. The study type is a meta-analysis of placebo-controlled trials. This meta-analysis sought to answer two questions. One, which antipsychotics are the most effective in acute mania? And two, how does the optimal dosing differ between mania and schizophrenia? To answer the first question, the authors searched for blinded, randomized control trials using flexibly dosed antipsychotics in acute bipolar mania, and they selected 42 studies, totaling 11,396 patients with a mean age of 39 years. They compared antipsychotics by their anti-manic efficacy at week 3 of treatment and created the following rank lists: risperidone, effect size 0.82, haloperidol, effect size 0.74, paliperidone, 0.71, cariprazine, 0.57, aripiprazole, 0.53, olanzapine, 0.49, quetiapine, 0.42, acenapine, 0.37, ziprasidone, 0.33, brexpiprazole, 0.12, and placebo, 0.05. Notably, risperidone was significantly more effective than olanzapine. Because these were flexibly dosed studies, the authors used the mean dose to arrive at the optimal dose for each antipsychotic. Those were quetiapine, 618 mg, ziprasidone, 119 mg, aripiprazole, 24.6 mg, acenapine, 18.3 mg, haloperidol, 10.1 mg, paliperidone, 9.1 mg, cariprazine, 7.9 mg, risperidone, 4.8 mg, and brexpiprazole, 3.3 mg. To answer the second question, the authors converted the optimal doses from mania studies to olanzapine equivalents and compared them to published data on optimal olanzapine dose equivalents in schizophrenia. Optimal doses for acute mania were higher for quetiapine, 28.5%, and aripiprazole, 17%, but were lower for haloperidol, negative 8.1%, and risperidone, negative 15.8%. In other words, treatment of acute mania relative to schizophrenia required a higher mean dose of quetiapine, 618 versus 482 milligrams, and aripiprazole, 24.6 versus 21 milligrams. But it required a lower mean dose of haloperidol, 10.1 versus 11 milligrams, and risperidone, 4.8 versus 5.7 milligrams. So I'll repeat that again without the numbers. In the treatment of acute mania relative to schizophrenia, it required a higher mean dose of quetiapine and aripiprazole, but a lower mean dose of haloperidol and risperidone. Then, dosing of ziprasidone was not different between acute mania and schizophrenia, and there were not enough published data for the other antipsychotics in schizophrenia to compare their dosing between mania and schizophrenia. The main limitation is built into the network design, which assumes that outcomes are comparable across studies. In reality, many aspects of a study's design influence a drug's effect. While other analyses support the high ranks of risperidone and haloperidol in mania and the low rank for brexpiprazole, we should note that paliperidone, which was ranked third here, failed to obtain FDA approval in mania due to inconsistent results in its trials. The authors also did not look at long-term trials, which would have identified a higher risk of precipitating depression when haloperidol is used in mania. Carlat take. Risperidone and haloperidol are reliable options if anti-manic efficacy is the goal, with the caution that haloperidol may cause depression. This study also offers guidance on antipsychotic dosing. Most antipsychotics have similar target levels for acute mania and schizophrenia, with the exceptions of quetiapine and aripiprazole, which require higher dosing in mania, and haloperidol and risperidone, which require slightly lower dosing in mania. And that concludes our August 2024 Carlat Psychiatry Report. If you want to earn CMEs or CE credits, just log on to www.thecarlatreport.com and take the post-test. And I have nothing better to do, so I'll read out our five questions for this month. The first one, which medications shows benefit as an add-on treatment for OCD due to its modulation of serotonin and dopamine systems? A. Fluoxetine, B. Ondansetron, C. Clomipramine, or D. Topiramate. Our second question is, what is the ultimate goal of the collaborative assessment and management of suicidality approach? A. To work with patients exclusively through telehealth, B. to help patients understand the reasons for their suicidal ideation, C, to enable patients to pursue a life worth living, or D, to challenge cognitive distortions that lead to suicidal ideation. Question number 3 is which neurotransmitters are thought to be influenced by transcranial direct current stimulation, TDCS? A, acetylcholine and glutamate, B, GABA and norepinephrine, C, endorphins and oxytocin, or D, serotonin and dopamine. 4. In a study by Chia Ling et al., that's the study from the research update, which antipsychotic had the highest effect size in acute bipolar mania? A, quetiapine, B, paliperidone, C, risperidone, or D, brexpiprazole. And our last question, number 5, what are the safety concerns with the use of TDCS? A, increased risk of seizures, B, risk of skin irritation and headaches, C, risk of addiction, or D, risk of hallucinations.